This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Liz Smith is one of America's most famous gossip columnists. Before we meet her, let's hear a clip from what is probably the best movie about the business, the 1957 film The Sweet Smell of Success. Burt Lancaster plays a ruthless gossip columnist. Tony Curtis is a press agent who'll do anything to get his clients into the column. In this scene, the columnist and the press agent are talking at a restaurant when they're interrupted by a senator.
May I ask you a naive question, Mr. Falco? Exactly how does a press agent work?
Well, answer the man, Sidney. He's trying to take you off the hook.
You just saw a good example of it, Senator. A press agent eats a columnist's dirt and is expected to call it manna.
But don't you help columnists by furnishing them with items?
Sure. A columnist can't do without us, except our good and great friend J.J. forgets to mention that. You see, we furnish him with items.
What, some cheap, gruesome gags?
You print them, don't you?
Yes, with your clients' names attached. That's the only reason the poor slobs pay you, to see their names in my column all over the world. Now I make it out you're doing me a favor?
I didn't say
the day I can't get along without a press agent's handouts, I'll close up shop and move to Alaska lock, stock, and barrel.
Liz Smith says that when she got started in the 50s, gossip was a cynical business, kind of like it was represented in the film. One of her early jobs was working for a theater press agent, trying to get items into columns by Walter Winchell and Dorothy Kilgallen. Then Smith ghost-wrote Igor Cassini's society column, Charlie Knickerbocker. She started writing a daily column under her own name in 1976 at the New York Daily News. Her syndicated column is now carried in over 70 papers. Liz Smith has written a memoir called Natural Blonde. I asked about her ethics when she's publishing personal news. She told me it all depends on the source.
When Nora Ephron told me she was divorcing Carl Bernstein, I didn't feel I had to check that out with anybody. But ordinarily, I might call a lawyer, say, is this just a rumor? Or is it really in process? Is it actually going to happen? Might try to call the parties involved or call one of them, depending on what the other one said. You know, you want to give them both a chance to say their piece.
If a person is involved with something or has a problem that they really don't want to make public, and you know that they don't want to make it public, but you've found out about it, how much does their desire to not have it be public count for you? Or is that irrelevant because if you can prove that it's true, you can just print it?
Well, I never wanted to write the nastiest gossip column in America, and I always held back from writing things that were intensely hurtful, though some people don't think I did. But, you know, I don't generally write items about situations where people are obviously ill, where they need drug treatment or they need alcohol, need to go to AA, or they might be good if they checked in at the Betty Ford Clinic. I would sort of hold back on that unless it became a matter of public behavior that was so outrageous that there was no point. Just like I wouldn't be the one to write about an extramarital affair, because I just think that's too dangerous and hurtful. It's too hurtful. I don't want the wife or the husband to read about it in my column. I'd rather just pass the item up.
Now, Nora Ephron once gave you the story that she and Carl Bernstein were divorcing. Then Bernstein called you and said it wasn't true and he begged you not to print it. But you did print it. Tell me what went through your mind in deciding whether to go with it or not.
Well, I felt I had the facts from her. She intended to divorce him and she wanted it printed. And so I didn't pay much attention to his desire not to print it. I printed that they would divorce, and he was furious with me forever after. I mean, someone's desire that you not print news is not totally germane to the process of getting correct news out. And I felt Nora was a pretty good source as to whether or not she was going to divorce Carl. They had been, you know, written about quite a lot. I mean, he was having an open affair with someone, and it had been in the paper, not by me. And so I knew she was serious. This was quite a piece of news to those who cared about them.
What do you think she wanted it in your column? How would it have helped her?
I feel she wanted to not have to answer any more questions, and she wanted it to be definite, and she wanted to put him on notice how serious she was. I don't know that I thought about that at the time, but now I think that's what it was. I think she used my column to make it permanent, to make him see she was serious, because I guess he was arguing with her that she should forgive him and forget it. They should go on being married together.
Now, you met Carl Bernstein at a party after that, and he told you that you'd ruined his life. In what way did he think you'd ruined his life?
Well, I didn't pay attention to his protest, and I guess he felt I was responsible in some way for his happiness. I mean, I thought that was ridiculous.
Did anyone ever talk you out of writing something? Did anyone ever call you and say, please don't go with that?
Oh, my God.
It's really
going to
hurt me. Yeah. What are those conversations like?
Well, I try to talk them into it. And in fact, a part of my work, I feel, is trying to talk people into agreeing with me that it would be better for me to cover the story than to have it appear in Page Six or the National Enquirer. And sometimes this works. If I say, you know, this is all around town and everybody knows it, it's going to be printed anyway, so why don't you think about a way that I might be able to print it first and get it all out of the way? And this is a good argument to some of them, to some people.
What do you tell them the advantage would be if you printed it as opposed to, say, a tabloid?
Well, I would have their cooperation in telling me the facts from their point of view. And I might be sympathetic or I might not, but I mean, I wouldn't be out to try to drive them into the ground like a nail, and they know that.
Now, you became friends with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton when they were married, and they were, I mean, among the most prized subjects of gossip of the time. After you became friends, was it difficult to figure out what was printable and what was private?
No, they gave me really free rein and access to them, and I followed them around, and I would stay with them in places in Europe and observe them for, like, while they were making movies, or one of them was making one. And so I don't recall their ever asking me not to print anything. They weren't that way, but they were performing for me. You know, they were doing their married thing.
Well, what a strange position to be in, that people are performing their marriage for you as opposed to actually living
their marriage. Well, I think they were very taken with their love affair and the fact that they had married against public opinion and that they'd been beleaguered by the paparazzi all over the world and despised and denounced by the Vatican. So they wouldn't have stood still for publicity without thinking it would, you know, be to their benefit. And I always thought they put on a great show for me when I was around. And I got some fabulous stories about them. I wrote about them in Rome, in Paris, in London, in Moscow.
What was one of your favorite stories about them?
My favorite story about them is a story about them eating. They were great gourmands, and they constantly were talking about what they wanted to eat or what they would eat if it wouldn't make them fat or what they had eaten in the past. And I wrote a whole article on this, and I think it's terribly funny and very revealing of them.
My guest is Liz Smith. She's written a new memoir called Natural Blonde. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Liz Smith is my guest, and she has a new memoir called Natural Blonde. One of your biggest scoops, you say, is a story that you say put you on the map, was shortly after you got your own column in the New York Daily News. And this was, I think, in 1976. Kitty Kelly had leaked you information from the forthcoming Woodward and Bernstein book, The Final Days, their book about the last days of the Nixon administration. Now, a couple of a newspaper and a magazine had paid a lot of money to excerpt this book before publication, and you got some of the tidbits in it for free before they got a chance to excerpt the book. Why did Kelly leak it to you? How did she get it, and why did she leak it to you?
She was one of Carl Bernstein's authentic truth-sayers. A lot of people do like to tell you what's going on and what they know. It's amazing. But they're not press agents anymore. They're just ordinary people who like to gossip.
Well, she's a professional gossip. I mean, she's written very gossipy memoirs about celebrities.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, she was in no position to do anything with this very fragile, briefly newsy information, which was going to be published any second in the Washington Post and in Newsweek. So she decided she'd give it to me. And I got a big scoop. It went around the world. It made me famous. We described Nixon and Kissinger praying on their knees. And, oh, it was an incredible story. The paper called me, the Daily News telephoned me and said, you don't know what you've given us. This is so great. So it was a big scoop, and it infuriated Newsweek and infuriated the Washington Post, and I don't blame them.
Did you owe Kitty Kelly big time after that?
Well, she already owed me big time, so I thought we were even.
What did she owe you for?
I had given her all of my files on Jacqueline Kennedy.
Oh, for her book on Jackie. Uh-huh.
Yes, and I had always tried to help her, and I had helped her, or would. The sequence of events here might be a little wrong, but I did help her a lot later on her book on Frank Sinatra.
Is that part of how the game is played? People owe each other favors, and they pay back with information?
No, I think, again, it's more the truth-saying impulse. I mean, if I knew something and somebody was writing a book, I would offer to help them if I liked them, thought they were a reputable writer. When I gave Kitty my files, I didn't know what kind of writer she was. I just thought she was a very amusing and funny and dishy girl.
In your book, you write about how you helped Rock Hudson cover up something that he was being blackmailed about. Was he being blackmailed by somebody who was trying to out him?
Well, I assumed that's what it was. I said the other evening on 60 Minutes that when he called me, he told me this woman was going to print a story about his homosexuality. But in retrospect, I'm not sure that that's exactly what happened. I'm beginning to try to remember that we may have just had the conversation without any mention of what she was trying to reveal, because it really wasn't necessary. He knew that I understood.
What could you do to help him?
Well, I didn't know what I could do. I was appalled. I hate blackmail, and I knew that this kind of story would really effectively ruin his career as a romantic leading man. Those were very different times than now, though not totally different. And I said I'd call him back. So later I thought a little bit about this lady who was going to reveal the story. And I looked through my files, and I found, lo and behold, I found a file on her. She wasn't a star or a public person, but she was someone that I had known slightly, and I had some information on her that wasn't too savory, that I would never have printed. So I sent the file to him, and I said, I suggest you show this to her. And he did, and she dropped her plan to go to the tabloids. So he had a few more decades of peace, I guess. The poor guy, he finally died in a most horrible way.
You knew Rock Hudson was gay, right?
I didn't know it for many years. I met him early in the 50s, and I knew him a long time before I heard that he was gay or thought that he was. He never acted in any way to make me think he was. And in fact, I was around him a lot on a movie location in Rome where he was making For Whom the Bell Tolls. And I didn't know then that he was gay. I had a big crush on him.
When you did find out that he was gay, did you consider printing it, or?
Oh, no, of course not. Why would I help him stop somebody else from printing it if I would have printed it?
No, why would that qualify as something that you wouldn't print, whereas, say, somebody's divorce is something that you would print?
Well, people live over divorces, but people used to absolutely hardly live over being revealed as gay. I still don't write that people are gay unless they are self-avowed and openly gay. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very I think outing people is a very cruel thing. And I don't write about the children of celebrities either, though I get a lot of news about a lot of them. But I never wrote about John and Caroline Kennedy. I just didn't think, they didn't ask for their notoriety. So they're just things I try to stay away from.
Now, a question a lot of people expected you to address in your memoir is whether you're straight, gay, or bisexual. Time magazine has a review, you've probably seen it, where the headline is, Liz Outs Self, Sorta. And it says, if you can call this coming out, it is one of the weirder coming outs in the history of the genre.
Well, it's okay with me. I mean, it's okay with me that they think that. I have spent a lifetime of conflicting experiences, and I try to tell that in the book. And I just am not going to categorize myself. So it's okay if other people want to categorize me. I don't care what they say, but I'm not going to do it myself. I might change my mind tomorrow. I have changed my mind many times.
Well, you do write about a brief romance when you were in college with a woman student who was engaged, and the relationship ended after your parents read your love letters. You refer to this in your book as your ill-fated affair with the, quote, wrong sex, which is, I guess, what your parents called it?
That's right. Boy, at the time, that was really a fact. I'm writing that in the context of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly considered the wrong sex, and it certainly made them unhappy and made me unhappy. I had a very unhappy experience. So I try to tell about that to sort of illustrate the conflicts that young people go through when they think they're madly in love and can't live without somebody and the person doesn't seem suitable.
Then the next relationship you had was with a man, the way you describe it in the book.
Well, I had already been married when this other incident happened. I'm just not settled in this. I'm not going to nail myself in the box. It's okay if somebody else wants to.
No, you know, what a lot of people are trying to figure out, too, reading your book, is whether the 15 years that you lived with a close companion who was a woman was an intimate relationship or not. Now, I'm not asking you to answer that question. Here's my question. Wait, I'm going to ask you my question. My question is it any of our business? As someone who's a gossip columnist, is it any of our business what the nature of that relationship was?
It's okay if people want to make it their business, but I think I was pretty straightforward about that. I think if you read my book, you don't have to read so much between the lines. You can figure it out for yourself.
Oh, so the answer is then?
Well, I had a very intense companionship with this wonderful person who's still a very good friend of mine. I guess the answer is yes, but I mean, I think you'd know that from reading the book.
My guest is syndicated gossip columnist Liz Smith. She's written a new memoir called Natural Blonde. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with gossip columnist Liz Smith. When we left off, we were talking about how she's tried to keep private the fact that she had a 15-year relationship with another woman. Now, did anyone ever try to blackmail you during your years, you know, just to say that you had or that you were having a relationship with another woman? And did you worry about that possibility? You'd seen it happen to other people.
Yes, I worried about it mainly because it would reflect on another person who wasn't a public person. And this is something I guess all people in the public eye worry about their significant others if they're, you know, embroiled in anything controversial or so forth. It makes you worry about the private person you're involved with. Yes, I was constantly being attacked by the underground gay press and by people sending anonymous letters and things, but I managed to live through it.
Attacked by the gay press for not coming out?
For not coming out. They wanted me to be a role model for a gay life, and I wasn't always leading a gay life. I wasn't ready to be their role model, and I'm still not.
Did anyone threaten you in such a way that it could have, ruined your career? Did anyone threaten?
I don't think it could have ruined my career. I was very popular. For the first 7 years I wrote my column, I couldn't do anything wrong. And then I made a joke and said, for the next 7 years, I couldn't do anything right. No, my column has always been very popular, and I've been in demand. I've worked for 9 newspapers in New York City.
I guess here's what I'm wondering. What was it like, or what has it been like, to be in the position where you're always interested in reporting on celebrities' private lives, but you have or had something in your private life that you really wanted to keep from the public, and it's the kind of thing that the public would have been real interested in hearing about?
Well, I can't account for the public's taste. It's like the reaction to this book. As soon as you even say the word sex, you don't have to say bisexual, you don't have to say gay, as soon as you say the word sex, everybody thinks I've written a book about sex. And I think it's the least part of my book. As for your question, I just went my way and continued working, and an awful lot of people swirled around me who seemed to want to, you know, do something to damage me. But I think that's perfectly normal, and I don't really object anymore to people responding against gossip columnists any way they please.
But again, just in terms of what it was like to have something you really wanted to keep private, something really central to your life.
Well, I wanted to keep private because it would be hurtful to someone else.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think I would be fired or anything. I wasn't, no matter what people wrote and did.
So you were more worried about your partner than you were about yourself.
Right. And other people, my parents and my brothers, my nieces, my nephews. I had a wonderful family. I didn't want to embarrass them.
But again, I'm wondering if that was an odd burden to be carrying around while you were in the business of writing about other people's lives and private lives.
Well, let's don't kid ourselves. Every person who has any kind of deviant sexuality in their life, or sexuality described as deviant, is carrying a burden. I don't think they're, you know, even openly gay people are still beaten to death, and bad things happen to them sometimes. This country has an extremely puritanical streak, and it still has it. It's very Victorian in certain ways.
I guess let me put this more bluntly. Did you ever feel like it was hypocritical of you to know that there was something in your life that you really had to protect, while at the same time you were trying to make public things from other people's lives that they might have wanted to protect?
Well, maybe it was hypocritical, but I don't think hypocrisy is anything new in any stratification of society. So I just did the best I could, and I always tried to be fair to whatever I was writing. I tried very hard to be fair, to give people a chance to answer, to tell two sides of things, if it seemed to me there was one, and to not complain too much about what people said about me.
How long do you think you will want to keep your column?
Well, as long as it seems viable and it works and people like it and there's a demand for it and the papers keep renewing my contract and I'm healthy and able to work. I'm, knock wood, in very good health, and I'll go on, I guess, till I drop in my tracks or they throw me out.
Now, in your book, you call gossip the tawdry jewel in the crown of free speech. Gossip is often used as an almost dirty word. It's just gossip. What do you like about gossip?
What do you like about it? Don't you like it? Or are you too pure to like it? You know, I mean, I think that gossip is absolutely endemic, and I mean, substantive in human nature. I think we're all constantly talking about each other and about what we think we know or heard or saw, overheard. And we use this sort of medium of exchange between us to enhance the human condition. It helps us figure out what we think. It helps us sort out our ideas Morally, did we approve when we're gossiping? Are we approving or are we disapproving? Or are we trying to figure out what we think? And I think that a lot of gossip is just this idea of let me tell you a story.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Liz Smith has written a new memoir called Natural Blonde.